Radio Tux. The German Linux Radio. The German Linux
Radio. Guten Morgen, hier von der CeBIT. Der erste Interviewgast heute Morgen ist John Mad Dog Hall von Linux International. Und ja, das wird auf jeden Fall ein englisches Interview, aber ihr könnt hier zuhören und natürlich auch im Chat. Wenn irgendwelche Fragen sind, vielleicht schaffen wir die hier auch einzubinden. Auf jeden Fall, we will switch to English now. Good morning here from the CeBIT 2011. And yeah, with me now is John Mad Dog Hall from Linux International. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Yeah, first of all, how are you?
Well, I'm a little tired from last night because we went over to the Munich Hall and we had dinner with some old friends and we had much beer. And I have a set of BSD blinking horns here with me today. So okay. I'll put those on. Unfortunately, the radio people can't see them, but...
But we will collect some images and...
They're quite nice. They have actually four settings, or three settings. One is fast blink, one is slower blink, and finally there is constant on. So, and I was showing these to some of the Linux people, and they said, oh, now all you need is a tail. And I said, well, if I had a tail, I'd be Steve Ballmer.
but why the Linux people haven't such cool things? I mean... We need a blinking tux or I don't know.
Well, we do have cool things. I mean, we do have tux, and there's even tux droid, the little tux doll that can wander around and you can program and things like that. I think that we have quite a few cool things with Linux. And that actually, you know, kind of brings about a question because, BSD obviously was there before Linux. And there was a time where the BSD people came to me when I was working at Digital. They said, why don't you pay as much attention to BSD as you do to Linux? Why don't you give us as much equipment and everything? And I said, well, you know, show me three BSD magazines and show me five BSD user groups around the world and show me more than one distribution of BSD, you know, for any one free BSD. I said, you know, if you can show me that, then I'll give you as much equipment and everything as Linux. And they couldn't. You know, quite frankly, what they kept saying is, our kernel is better than Linux. You know, technically we're better than Linux. And what, unfortunately for them, what I realized is two things. Number one, that Linux was improving at a very rapid rate and would soon be as good as BSD in a lot of areas. And number two, it isn't actually technical competence that sells operating systems, because if that was true, Microsoft would still be waiting to sell their first copy. What it is marketing and image and group and things like that. That's what really sells, and partnerships, and the Linux community was very good at creating those.
And why isn't the BSD community, I mean, what is the difference? I mean, yeah, they're also cool guys.
Well, yeah, but they were cool guys, but, you know, I've thought this over quite a bit, and I think that there was just a series of things that came together that Linux, for instance, was very welcoming to bring people in, and I think the BSDs had more of a clique in their development groups, that they were more of a closed development than the Linux kernel. You know, there was a lot of Linux distributions that were starting up, and people could see I could take these things and put them together and create yet another distribution. Some people think that that's a detriment to Linux, but I think it's a great strength that Linux, that people can create a Linux distribution relatively easily. But the other thing I think that moved it forward was, back in those times, you know, developers looked a little bit scruffy. And, you know, and here was this nice young man from Helsinki, Finland, who, hair was combed fairly nicely and everything. He spoke English fairly well with this nice lilting Finnish accent, and the press
Swedish,
just fell in
Swedish accent.
Well, no, he's from Finland. He's
yeah,
from Finland.
But he
yeah,
speaks,
I know he speaks Swedish, but you know, it's Finnish Swedish accent. But you know, I mean, and people in the United States didn't know the difference anyway. So.
Okay.
And it just caught their imagination, you know. I mean, there were almost these rumors going around that Linus had written the entire Linux kernel by writing ones and zeros in the back of a shovel by the firelight, you know. I mean, you know, things like that were going around, and it just caught people's imagination. And I think that was a big thing.
Yeah. And this is 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, to be quite fair, when he first started out, it didn't get that much attention. A lot of this attention happened more in the period of 1995, 1996. There were areas, there were times where you could see a step function in the progression of Linux. And quite frankly, because I've brought out lots of operating systems, It followed the same path. I mean, you start off with an operating system and you don't have any applications for it. Well, fortunately, with Linux, I mean, you have kind of built-in applications. But the other thing, the thing that really made it take off was the advent of the web and people needing inexpensive servers. Because at the time, if you had a server, it was typically a Sun Spark box, or it was an MVS system, or something that was relatively expensive and closed source. And all of a sudden, here was this thing that you could create an inexpensive server at a fraction of a cost, and you had all the source code for it. So in case anything went wrong, you could fix it rapidly. And it just all happened at the right time. And Linux took off in the server market. And people were creating websites, and they were creating, you know, all these types of things, and the ability to log in and set up bulletin boards, things like that. Then the next thing that happened was the databases decided to port. Again, there was pressure from their companies, but you know, or from their customers, but people like Oracle and Informix and Sybase, they decided to support Linux. And this is the way that lots of operating systems happen. The key applications to start off are typically the database engines. And they port, and that makes the operating system legitimate. And then after that, more and more applications start to port. And so Linux followed exactly the same path. It was very interesting.
So was it just the right time to start Linux? I mean, there were Unix, there were BSD, there were Windows, and something like that.
I think it was the right time for three reasons. Number one, the 386 processor had been out for a while, and this was actually what started Linus wanting to write his own kernel, was because he had just gotten a brand new 386 processor. And he recognized the operating system that came with it didn't really take advantage of the CPU, because the operating system that came with it still had to support 286s and 186s, which were swapping style of operating systems. They did not use demand page virtual memory, and the 386 could support that, and Linus knew that. He also knew that Unix systems could take advantage of that, but there was no Unix systems out there that he could afford and that he could play with. So that's why he decided to write his own. Now, that would have been one thing, but the other things that allowed Linux to take off rapidly was the fact that internet was now cheap enough that it was starting to go into people's homes. It wasn't just at the university, it wasn't just at a company, it was coming into people's homes, and so people in their spare time could sit at home with this 386 processor or 486 processor and actually work on a significant kernel that would do significant work. So the dropping in price, the fact that 386s have been out long enough that some people would say, well, I've got a 486, that's my main machine, I'll take this old 386 and I'll put Linux in it, right? And then the third thing was just the availability of the technical information to allow people to know how a kernel worked, how it was written. There was enough different examples around, including the BSDs, that people could see how things worked and start to go in and apply that to this kernel called Linux.
But why then Windows, when it came along, started to rush over and, yeah, it's now the main operating system on these machines, on the desktops and laptops at home?
Well, you have to remember, Windows has been out for a long time, okay? I mean, Windows 3.1 was the first implementation of Windows that was actually popular, and it's been out for a long time. Plus the fact they had an industry behind it. Now, this is one of the things that I think I've lent to Linux, is that when I got involved with Linux, you know, there was about 124,000 people using Linux, a guess, an estimate. And a lot of those people were working on the kernel, trying to make it better. But they were mostly, it was looked at as a technical thing or a hobbyist thing or maybe a little bit of a research thing. But people weren't looking at it as a commercial thing, something that business could use. And I came along and I took a look at it and says, no. I see this as something that has great commercial value for business. And that was because I'd been in the commercial operating system space for a long time, and I knew how frustrating it was for customers to sit there and wait for a patch that would allow them to do their work. And there was nothing they could do other than encourage their supplier to create that patch. And I also knew the frustration of being a vendor, that you want to deliver this stuff. You want to make your customers happy, but there's tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of them that all want something different. And you've got a limited number of engineers and a limited capability to do what you have to do. So I was a product manager of Digital Unix for a long time. And one time I said, okay, we're going to do this release right. We're going to get all the product requirements put together. You know, we're going to prioritize them from most important to least important based on a whole series of things. Yes, there's some new hardware we have to support. Yes, there's some new standards we have to work on. Yes, all this stuff. You know, so we created a list of 600 product requirements with a definition of each one, and we prioritized them, and then I handed them to my engineering staff, and we had 500 engineers working on Digital Unix, not all of them directly on Digital Unix, but some on compilers, some on hardware device drivers, things like that. And I said, how many of these can you do? You've got a year to do these. How many of these can you do? And they came back and they said, we can do the top 100 and maybe another two or three down below. I said, but what about the other 500 product requirements? And they kind of giggled and they said, we'll do that in the next release. Well, if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you in New York City, because in the next release, there's going to be other product requirements. There's going to be more hardware to support. There was going to be some large customer to come along and say, oh, yeah, you do this for me and I'll buy a million systems, which they never did. So The requirement that you put in as a customer went further down the list instead of going further up the list. And so you may never see the requirement that you had. Yes, the feature you wanted. And so that's taking the control of your software out of your hands and putting it into the hands of some company. So Richard Stallman talks about freedom. You know, freedom to see the code, stuff like that. I talk about slavery, okay? So if you're using closed source proprietary code, you're a software slave, because there's a manufacturer out there that's telling you what to do, where to go, where to put it on the system, you know, when to upgrade, stuff like that. And you've lost control. You're not in control of your software anymore, okay? And particularly if you've got software that's only produced by one vendor, and you know they're the ones to say what happened to it.
Yeah, and if the company is not there anymore, you lost your ability to use the hardware or the software.
Oh yeah, I mean, what happens if the company goes out of business, right? What happens if the company drops that product line? They say, oh, we're not going to do that anymore, right? I mean, here's Google, one of the largest companies, right? And they said they started up this thing called Wave. And one of the companies I was doing consulting for, they got all excited about it. And they started, oh, we can do all these things with Wave. And I says, I'm not sure that's a good idea. You know, Wave is not even in beta yet. And it's kind of an alpha, and I don't really see a path for it. Oh, no, no, no. Well, you know, a couple years later, Google says, well, we were just kind of kidding about Wave. And, you know, or look at Nortel, one of the largest telephone companies in the world. In over a two-year period of time, they out of business, you know, or Digital Equipment Corporation, or Wang, or Apollo, or Compaq Computer Corporation. You know, I mean, they all were very large companies at one time, and they go out of business. And what happens if you were using their hardware or their software? You know, where do you go? How, you know, you have to change, and it may not be done in your time frame.
Okay, let's get back to Linux.
Get back to Linux. I thought I'd been talking about Linux all along.
No, just we were at freedom.
So you lost control, and you're nervous about it, right? I'm just rattling on, you know? Go ahead.
Okay, after Linux started and come along, what happened then? I mean, okay, there were some people using it, but now it's a multi-million, billion-dollar business.
Yeah, and nice thing about it is because Linux is so freely available that people can start up a business without having to ask anybody's permission. You know, so if you have proprietary closed source software, the people that make that software are, by the definition, the experts of it. They know how it's built. They know how it works. They know the algorithms they use and things like that. So if you want to create training based around that product, you're always going to be a secondary trainer because you might study it. You might look at it from the outside. You might guess on how it works and things like that. You can read their manuals, but you'll never know how it actually works until you see the source code. But with Linux, you can see the source code. And if you study it, you could be just as good at training as the person who wrote it. In fact, you might be a better trainer than the person who wrote it because maybe they're not a good trainer at all. They're a great programmer, yeah. They're a good coder, but you know, they couldn't teach somebody if their life depended on it. So you could form a business around teaching that software. You know, you can help people integrate it better. You can help people make their business better. And that's the great thing about free software. It's not limiting somebody. You have control.
Yeah, but now Linux is on at least everybody's life. I mean, you have a smartphone, you have a router at home where mainly Linux is used and something like that. It's a big history and a success story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and people keep pointing out, you know, what about the desktop? They say, well, what about the desktop? Yeah. You know, we live in a kind of a strange environment, you know, Germany, United States, where there's lots of people who have computers. But the latest count says there's about 1.25 billion desktop computers, but there's 6.3 billion people on the face of the planet, which means that about 5 billion people have not selected their desktop yet.
Okay, but that was also 10 years ago. We thought about that.
Yes, but the thing is, the price of the hardware keeps dropping, okay? Now, a lot of these people make very, very small amount of money, and it's very difficult for them to afford to buy any type of computing equipment. I mean, that's a lot of why they don't have it. But as the price of the hardware keeps dropping, and not only that, but the price of the hardware keeps dropping, the power of the hardware keeps going up. And so what you have is when people do upgrade their computers, the upgraded computer or the one that they've replaced is a perfectly viable system for somebody. It may not be the world's fastest gaming machine, but it's something that could actually run somebody's business. And, you know, so the people now have a piece of hardware. The thing is that the license of the software that comes with that says you can't transfer that software to somebody else legally, okay? So now they have to say, well, I either rebuy the software, which costs a lot of money, or I pirate the software, which is illegal, and I might actually get in trouble sometime, or I use free software. And when they start looking at the power of all this free software that's out there, and they find out that they could basically build enough software to create a business and not have to pay anybody thousands of dollars for that software, this allows them, this empowers them to start this little business. And this is why a lot of these countries in emerging nations are starting to look at Linux. That, plus the fact that their governments are realizing that if all they ever do is buy packaged software from outside of their country, then they don't develop the expertise inside of their country develop that software.
They lost the know-how, or they didn't build it up.
Right. And I've actually been to some of these countries where they teach computer science in the university. I talk to the graduates who are about to graduate and say, what are your plans? What are your plans for the future? And they go, oh, well, I'm going to move to England, or I'm going to move to Spain, or I'm going to move to the United States. I go, why? Well, if I stay here, I can't get a decent job. You know, I get a job installing software, or I get a job doing that, but I can't get a job programming. And this is wrong. I mean, a person should be able to stay in their own country and get a good job. And they should be able to do what they want to do. And if that is writing, you know, complex software because it's a challenge and they like doing that, they should be able to do that. So this is another reason why I like free software, because it enables countries to build their own IT infrastructure inside of the country.
And how will we get there?
Well, we are getting there. We're getting there because these countries, these emerging countries, are saying, hey, you know, we're going to start using free software. Not only because to keep money from flowing out of our country in a balance of payments problem, but also because, you know, we're developing this ability to sustain ourselves. There's this little island off the coast of Florida. You may have heard of it. It's called Cuba.
Yeah.
Okay. And for 40 years, the United States has had an embargo against Cuba. Now, technically speaking, they can't use Windows. Fidel Castro can't call up Bill Gates and say, hey, Bill, I have a little problem with my operating system. If you fix it for me, I'll send you a box of cigars. Right? Well, I mean, even if Bill wanted to help Fidel, he can't, because he's a loyal U.S. citizen. And there's an embargo against us selling technical things to him. In fact, if you go to Red Hat's website pages, and if you go to Novell's website pages, you'll see that they can't ship their versions of Linux to Cuba because our State Department says that's illegal. So, you know, here's Cuba. Where do they get their computers from? Well, of course, they pirate their computers. They get them from other places.
Yeah, like
and they use
Mexico or something like that.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's more difficult because they can't legally talk to Microsoft to get the type of support that they need, right? So they're in the process of switching to free software, because free software, they can fix it. They can get the technical help they need to run their country. And I think this is the type of thing that people have to think about. You know, if you're thinking about your country and the sovereignty of your country, you know, now if you're a very small country like Monaco, it's difficult for you to be able to do everything. So you have to depend on other countries. But a country the size of Germany or the country the size of Cuba, you know, you should be able to do as much as you can to sustain yourself.
Yeah, it's but I don't see how the desktop I call it war is going to end in some years. So I mean, here in Germany, you see most people don't care about the operating system. They just use it on work and at home. And it's just so convenient
to use the pre-installed Windows, and so no one will switch?
Well, as I said, Germany and the United States are outside.
Lost.
Yeah,
they are lost.
Well, I don't say lost. I won't say lost completely, because I also believe that there's other factors that are happening. Okay, so many years ago, when packaged software first started coming out, I bought a piece of packaged software from a little company that was close to my house. I paid $1,000 for that, and I found a bug. And I called up the company. I says, "Hey, you know, I bought your software. I got a bug." I actually got the president of the company on the telephone line. And I told him what the problem was. He says, yeah, I know what that is. And he would say that because he was also the chief programmer, right? And he says, you know, I think we can fix that today and we can get it out. And he could say that because he was the head of QA. And he says, if we get it out today, you can have it tomorrow. And he could say that because he was the head of shipping. And sure enough, the next day I got these 2 8-inch floppy disks in the mail and everything was fine. But today, if I call up the little company, they've gotten a little bit bigger. They now have 150 engineers instead of 100. But today, if I call them, I don't get the president on the line or even the chief programmer or anything. You know, what I get is Muzak, right?
And
what? Well, I get a message that says, please press button number one for sales, button number two for support. And I get Muzak. And then after a while, I get disconnected. And the problem is, they now have 4.5 million customers, and they can't treat each customer the way they treated me. Now, true, they're selling their software for $34.95 instead of $1,000, but if I have a problem with it, I can't get the fix that I need.
Yeah.
And this problem's only going to get worse, because what's happening is more and more people are using software. And these people are trained less and less in how to use it. They need more and more support. And there's more and more diversity of the people. No longer are the people that are using software speaking one of the 5 major languages of the world. They're speaking a whole range of diverse languages. And they have diverse business needs that can't be met by a single company with a single staff of engineers. But with free software, you can make the business choice of changing the software to meet your specific needs. You have a business choice of leaving it alone and using it as it came, just the same as if you bought closed source proprietary software. Or you have the business choice of changing it. But that's your choice and not somebody else's.
Okay, so you're here now in Germany. We are on the CeBIT, and but what did you see here around? Was there anything interesting, people or stuff or,
Well, actually, being a child of computers, I haven't had much time to just wander around. But what I did before I came to CeBIT was I went to their site and I did a query for Linux and open source, and I got about 3 pages of vendors and 3 pages of vendors, just vendors, that all had the word Linux in it. And then I got something like 600 vendors who had open source in their description. And that's very, very satisfying for me, because about 13 years ago, when I started coming to CeBIT for the first time, there were no penguins around at all. Okay. In fact, there was only one company that I could find. No, 2 companies. SAP was using Linux. And then there was this company from Israel called Magic Software. And they were using Linux also. But those were the only 2 that I could find. And we had a small booth where we were giving away copies of Red Hat and SUSE and Caldera software. And then the next year we had a few more booths and a few more booths, and it kept the Linux area kept increasing.
And now it's the whole hall too here is dedicated to Linux, or at least the half hall, and
Well, it's not only that, but the thing is that a lot of these vendors are using Linux, but they're not necessarily going to be in the Linux area. They have their own booth, and they have they're treating Linux as another operating system. And that's good news, that for them, it's another platform. They're going to support it because their customers are asking for it. That's good news.
What do you think, where will Linux be in the next, let's say, 20 years?
Oh, 20 years, definitely world domination, okay? I mean, when Linus first started talking, he would go up there, he'd give this, he only had one slide to his talk, and it was a graph that started off at zero and showed world domination, okay?
Okay, now we're in the middle.
Yeah, we're about in the middle right now. And he would always show this slide. He says, you know, straight line from zero to world domination. And then at the end of his talk, he says, by the way, I want you to know that that straight line is plotted on a logarithmic graph, which meant, of course, that even though a straight line, it was actually exponential growth. And I think we're actually very, very good on that. You know, another thing which I think I brought to the Linux community is a sense of patience. You know, because I've been through a lot of operating system releases, and I know that they don't happen overnight. There's an inertia that has to happen. And just like any other form of inertia, you keep pushing, a constant push, and it goes faster and faster and faster. But it's not going to start up instantaneously. There's an inertia to the world. And I think that Linux is right on the path that it will go. I mean, you look at the top 500 supercomputers, and I did this just last week, all but five of them run either Linux or some variant of Linux. Okay. And the reason those five run Windows is because Microsoft pays them to. you know, embedded systems. We see that, you know, that Android is taking off. WebOS is built on top of the Linux kernel. And, you know, and then quite frankly, you know, the iPhone is built on BSD, FreeBSD. So I think in the Unix space, and I'll be interested to see what happens with Nokia and their Windows 7 deal.
Really pity, because they had this Linux-based Migo thing.
I know. It'll be sad to see Nokia go downhill.
Yeah. Yesterday, Klaus Knapper talked about the next 100 years of IT.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
Well, first of all, I had to correct him a little bit on his historical stuff. He was a little off on that, okay? He said that mainframes came in the 1980s. It was actually mainframes came first. Then there were mini computers. And the idea that time-sharing started in 1969, I'm sorry, the whirlwind at MIT in the 1950s did time-sharing, it did real-time, so he was off a little bit on that. Even Klaus admitted that he's a little bit pessimistic, and this is painting a little bit of a pessimistic thing. But I think, I look at what's happening now with things like the Arduino and, you know, open hardware, and I see particularly young people who want to know how things work and are, you know, they get excited about building their own stuff. So I have a little bit more hope for the future. On the other hand, you take a look at what's happening with artificial intelligence right now, and there's the concept that in the future the machines will become artificially intelligent, then they'll wonder why we human beings should be around. So there's something we should watch out for.
Yeah, and we should also watch out that the machines don't, that we just depend on them and can't do anything alone.
Well,
I mean, there are these scenarios where the machines take over the world and something like that, but...
Well, many years ago, I was teaching in college, and I was trying to teach binary arithmetic to my students. And after I was having a hard time doing that. I couldn't understand why. And then all of a sudden, I realized that my students couldn't do any type of arithmetic in any type of base, even base 10. And that was because they had learned to add and multiply by using this thing called Chisholm-Bop, where you used your fingers to do addition. And if they were carrying something, they couldn't add 2 and 5 and get 7, right? They couldn't do that. So I had to go back and actually show them what they were doing, that 5 plus 7 is not just the number 12. That's really a group of 10 with 2 left over, okay? And once they understood that, they go, oh, my God, it's all the same thing. I says, yes, it's right. You know, it's just a different base that you're dealing with. And we were dancing this conga line around the room. You know, it's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. And wouldn't you know it, that's the time the dean of instruction poked his head in the room, and I kind of waved at him, and he kind of gave this face like, there's this crazy guy again, you know. But they learned how to do binary arithmetic. Now, why is this important? Because today, in a lot of universities, there's a lot of professors who say, you don't need to know machine language. You don't need to know assembly language. And I think that's wrong, because the students need to understand how the computer actually works. They need to understand that if you keep your data in cache, that it's going to run a lot faster. I had a friend of mine do a study of taking two very large matrices and multiplying them together. And he wrote the code like your person would write the code if they'd taken Algebra 1. And it went at a certain speed. And then he inverted the second matrix, did the multiplication, and inverted the answer. He got the same result. But because he inverted the second matrix, all of the data tended to stay in cache. And the multiplication went 40 times faster. So in my career, I tend to do what I call real programming. Okay? If it doesn't take at least a week to find the answer, I'm not interested in it. Okay? If it doesn't take at least a terabyte or a petabyte, these days a petabyte of data, I'm not interested in it. It's just not interesting for me. Okay? And for these types of things, when you get it to go 40 times faster, that's important. I had this professor, he was down in Auckland, New Zealand, and this is many years ago, and he was trying to get one iteration of his problem done. Now, it took an entire week on his Spark station to get this done. And at that time, Auckland kept going through brownouts on the average of once every 3 days. He'd been trying to get one iteration of his problem done for an entire year. You know, and after he got one iteration done, he would take the answer of that, stick it back in, and run it again. He hadn't got it even 1 year. So we gave him an alpha system, and that shortens the time frame considerably so he could get an iteration out between brownouts. But before we left, I did say to him two things. I said, number one, you need an uninterruptible power supply on your system. Now, that wouldn't help him if the brownout was very long. But I says, the second thing is, haven't you ever heard of checkpoint restart? He goes, checkpoint restart? What's that? I said, you know. So after I explained it to him, he just kind of was rubbing his head because, I mean, if he had implemented checkpoint restart in his program, he could easily have gotten his iterations out. But he didn't know. And this is a problem. You know, people need to understand how the computer works. It isn't good enough just to teach them Java. Okay?
Okay. Then just let's imagine, where will IT or computer be in, let's say, the next century? What do you think?
Number one, I'm a terrible predictor of the future, okay? And quite frankly, when I started in 1969, if you told me that we're carrying around these really powerful computer systems that could store, could address 128 bytes of data for every square millimeter on the surface of the Earth, they didn't need to be water cooled. They didn't need have to have 220 voltage, you know. If you told me to have that, I would have called you crazy, you know. Just like my grandmother would have called you crazy if you said that people could be flying through the air, okay? So, you know, it's very hard to predict the future. You can look at some of the great stuff that's happening in research right now with nanotechnology, with light and light switching and things like that. you can take a look at that. You can take a look with the nanotechnology that we could actually go back and actually have a real analog computer that could actually work, and you wouldn't have to keep tuning all the time. So these types of things are very exciting, and it's very difficult to say where, you know, things are going to be. It's also a little bit unnerving that a lot of these things are going to require programming skills, where we still have problems writing the world, you know, writing a little piece of code that says "Hello World," and yet to really get the power of these new technologies, we're going to be able to have to conquer parallel programming and race conditions and things, and we're still struggling with that.
Okay, then back to your life. What are the next steps? What will you do? I mean, what events will you attend to? And
I've lost track of what the next event I'm supposed to go to, because they happen all the time. I've got them on my calendar, and that, you know, I'll be going to one down in Thistle. I am going to go to LinuxCon in Prague this year. I've never been to Prague. I've always wanted to go to Prague. And so when they had LinuxCon in Prague, I signed up immediately to go on that. It's going to be LinuxCon. It's going to be embedded LinuxCon at the same place, same time. And also the Kernel Summit. So Linus will probably be there in Prague for the Kernel Summit. So that's kind of exciting. What is my future? I'm working on Project Kawa, which is a project in South America to create jobs, to create environmentally friendly computers. And I hope that some of that technology will be applicable to other places. And, you know, and if that project takes off, if that project is successful, that will take a huge portion of my time to make sure that project is going in the right direction. And then I am 60 years old, so I have to start thinking about retirement. And for retirement, I've had this project for a long time that I've been working on called Mad Dog's Mansion and Marina of Math, Music, Microcomputing, Microbrewing, Microwinery, Microdistillery, and Bait Shop.
What?
and the thought process behind this is that today, When you've got these extremely powerful computer systems, I mean, my notebook that I just bought has 7 cores, 16 gigabytes of main memory, and a half terabyte disk inside of it, okay? And USB 3.0, because that's how I can back it up. Now, if you have that type of power in a processor that's in a laptop, you know, what you really need in a university is just bandwidth. You know, bandwidth. So that the students could do remote learning, you know. So I want to create a nice place for students to come to do the graduate studies, where they can watch the sun set over the ocean, or being students, they would watch the sun rise over the ocean. Okay, and they would matriculate. They would go to matriculate to different universities. So one of them might be going to Stanford, one might be going to Carnegie Mellon, one might be going to Cambridge, but they would all be doing this remotely, you know, over the internet. And then at night, they would all get together and exchange ideas. And then we would have a rapid brainstorming, exchanging of ideas. And if we got a good idea, then we would take it to a incubator and incubate it into a company. And then what I would ask of the students is 4% of the profits of that company to keep the school going. So by the time you had 25 good ideas, it's like you got the 100% of the profits of a very diversified company, which is funding the school to keep it going. Okay, and then the school would go into perpetuity that way. And so this is my idea. And in all of this, I mean, the school has to be in a very nice place. It has to be in a place where the students can go barefoot year-round. So it has to be fairly warm. And like I said, we're going to have the students brew beer, okay, you know, as a little hobby there. And that way when they sit down at night, they can share each other's beer and make comparisons and everything. And it'll be a nice place, and this will be my retirement project.
Okay? So not a real retirement.
Well, no, I mean I'll never really retire. I mean I can't do that. I mean that's just like you're dying, you're dead. Okay, I mean I keep telling people. I mean I got into a great job many years ago. I mean I almost became an electrical engineer. Okay. And there's nothing wrong with electrical engineering. It's just I was also almost electrocuted by 13,600 volts and 800 amps. You know, let me tell you something. When you've got that much power, if you aimed at this microphone, it'd just be a speck of dust, okay? It'd be vaporware. But I decided to go into software, right? Because the worst thing that could happen is to get my finger stuck in the keyboard or something, right? And I was going to be working in this nice air-conditioned room with humidity controlled and stuff. That was great. So the nice thing about software is that you don't even need a soldering iron, okay? You can just do it in your head. You know, it's pure logic, and it's instant gratification. You know, when you finally get the program to work, nobody has to pat you on the back and say you did a good job. You know you did a good job. So that's a great thing, and as long as I have a mind, as long as I can think, then I can work. And if I stop thinking, if I can't think anymore, well, then I must be dead. Okay, so that I'll never stop working, you know. I might slow down a little bit, but I'll never stop.
Okay. Then, thank you very much for having you here, John Maddock Hall. And we will continue with a little bit of music. And then at 10:30, the next talks will be given.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for having me.
Das war eine Sendung von Radio Tux, herausgegeben im Jahr 2011 unter Creative Commons by Sharealike.de, Lied eventuell anders lizenziert. Mehr Infos auf radiotux.de. Unterstützt von Open Coffee,
B-Linux
und Tarent,
Fairtrade Software.